Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
America is a country awash in guns, about 300 million of them for a population of roughly 323 million. Those facts are undisputed, despite current debates over gun rights and gun regulation, and most of us accept conventional wisdom that firearms have always been central to U.S. identity. But that part may not be the case. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Yes, we fought the American Revolution with guns, and yes, we made the right to keep and bear arms the Second Amendment in the Bill of Rights. But as my guest discovered, Americans in the past did not give what guns they had a whole lot of thought, and they didn't tend to be fonder of them than their other tools, things like axes and hoes and butter churns. Our national affection for guns came later and was influenced at least in part by savvy manufacturers marketing to domestic consumers between foreign wars. The new book by historian Pamela Haag is called The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. Pamela, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
What made you want to understand the history of guns in America?
Well, that's actually a long story. I'm not the typical person who writes about guns. Most books on guns are written either by people who really have a deep affection for guns or who have a deep aversion to them. But I actually came into this story through a ghost story. When I was a graduate student in New Haven, I learned the story of Sarah Winchester, who was Oliver Winchester's daughter-in-law. Oliver Winchester, of course, is famous for the Winchester repeater rifle. And the legend held that Sarah believed herself to be haunted by the spirits of everyone killed by Winchester rifles. So she captivated me, but she was elusive. I set the project aside, didn't give her much more thought until after Newtown, Connecticut in 2012. When I came to the realization that maybe the real mystery was more the gun industry and the story of Oliver Winchester and the creation of an American gun industry. And I realized I knew almost nothing about that theme historically.
What is the gun culture of this country? What do guns represent to us today?
Well, that's changed over time. One of the major arguments I'm trying to make in my book is that we haven't always had one particular feeling about guns or about all guns as a group, and that that's really changed over time. I think the trajectory is one of really looking more at guns as tools, you know, in the 1800s, useful weapons, things to have in certain contexts, to at the turn of the century really moving toward viewing guns as a commodity and an object that has much deeper value and meaning and that speaks to some emotional values as well. So I think it's changed, and I think it's important to recognize that kind of historical change over time, because today in political debates, the perception seems to be very static, that Americans have, quote-unquote, always loved guns, we've always seen them as central to our culture, and so on. So there isn't really an appreciation of that variation over time.
Who needed a gun in the early days of the United States, and for what purpose?
Well, looking at the records of the gun industry is interesting on that point, because I think I started this research with the usual assumption that Colts and Winchesters were just kind of flying off the shelves and that most Americans wanted to arm themselves. In reality, selling guns to American civilians and citizens was a challenging and tough business for these makers of modern rifles and the modern revolver, multi-firing arms. A lot of Americans who needed guns for very practical purposes, hunting, defense, home defense, opted for simpler, less glamorous weapons, you know, percussion muskets or Prussian model 39 caliber muskets. And this was even true with settlers who were headed west. So if you look at the ledger books of the biggest gun merchants in the 1800s, it's interesting that Americans didn't perceive themselves to need the most glamorous, famous weapons of our gun culture.
Despite the ads that came along later that said the gun that won the West.
Right. The gun that won the West is a slogan that the Winchester Company actually introduced in 1919 as part of a marketing campaign, and they were in competition with the Colts Company over which had actually won the West. The answer is probably neither, but that actually was a marketing slogan that was devised in the 20th century. That wasn't the wisdom of the 19th century.
Before you had Colts and Remingtons and Smith & Wesson and Winchester, if you needed a gun in the early United States, where did you get one?
Well, you went to a gunsmith, and this was one of the dilemmas that kind of started the gun industry. We never really had enough gunsmiths. There were some places that had quite a few, like Lancaster County in Pennsylvania. But we tended to be both undergunned and also undersupplied with people who could make guns. It was a laborious business to make a gun. Most gunsmiths tried to repair rather than create weapons from scratch. It could take a week or longer. The guns typically were heavy, difficult to use. There was an intimate one-on-one relationship between the gunsmith who made your gun and the consumer, the customer. Most gunsmiths actually did other things as well. They typically had other business in the blacksmith or the whitesmith line, so they might advertise that they made locks and forks and keys and other household objects. But the process before the gun industry began was very laborious. It was long, and each gun produced was quite unique. And gunsmiths would boast of that, that they had exceptional craftsmanship and that they made guns with a distinctive flair. But this was not such a good thing on the battlefield because you couldn't swap out parts.
Before I read your book, before I read your book, I knew one thing about Eli Whitney, and that was that he invented the cotton gin.
Yep. It's fascinating because, as some of his biographers note, Eli Whitney really invented something that revolutionized the economy of the South, as well as something that revolutionized the economy of the North, because he was really among the very, very first, if not the first, to devise a system of production of interchangeable parts for muskets.
And why was that such a big deal?
Well, this was 1798, and the U.S. government was again in desperate need of arms and had been relying on foreign markets to get arms. And Eli Whitney was in a state of financial despair and ruination, facing ruination. So he took on a contract to ambitiously produce 10,000 muskets. It's almost unheard of number in a few years. And this was really the start not only of a gun industry, but also just of industry generally. He proposed to use machines moved by water, as he put it, to make interchangeable, exactly precise, uniform parts for a musket so that the parts could be swapped out and he could produce at a much higher quantity much more quickly.
So this makes good sense for armies to acquire these because they can fix what breaks and make sure that everybody has the same gear.
Exactly. We were short on gunsmiths, and this was a way to innovate by having machine production, essentially. So it's a precursor to mass production and to industry. But as you say, it's important to recognize that the gun industry really began in the crucible of the government and as a military project. It didn't make sense for an ambitious entrepreneur who wanted to experiment with machine production to think that he could sell this number of muskets or rifles to a civilian population. The contracts, the guaranteed contracts for the military, for the government, is really what got the industry going, not this idea of commercial demand or civilian demand.
Okay, before we can talk more about poor, tortured Sarah Winchester, we should know about her father-in-law, Oliver Winchester. How did he go from making clothes to making guns?
Yeah, Oliver Winchester is a fascinating figure. He was born in 1810, and he first made his fortune on men's shirts. He located to New Haven in 1848, took out a patent to produce an improved men's neckband that would remedy the evil of the too-tight collar on the men's shirt. And he was quite successful in this enterprise. And one important thing about our first generation of gun industrialists is that they were all very enamored of how you made things more than the particular thing that they made. So many of them shifted from one object to another, and a lot of this technology kind of crossed across industries from textiles into guns. But Oliver never had, to our knowledge, any abiding interest in guns before he made his first investment in the gun industry in 1855. He was really looking for a place to put some of his capital to work. He saw something in the idea of a repeater rifle that obviously made him think, you know, this was worth the investment. But he wasn't someone who displayed guns in his home or even, to our knowledge, had ever shot one. So he was really much more interested in industry itself and not so much in the production of rifles, at least at first.
And what made the Winchester repeater such a game changer?
Well, the Winchester repeater, in a different design but with the same end result as the Colt revolvers, these were multi-firing arms. So previously, having to load a muzzle loader from a standing position on a battlefield was incredibly dangerous. The weapons tended to be very inaccurate. You could maybe get 2 shots off in a minute. I mean, that would be a good outcome. The repeater rifle was absolutely revolutionary in its design because it allowed for a mechanical arrangement that would reload and discard the old cartridge, reload a new one. So you could get off you could fire even up to 16 to 30 shots in a minute. So it's really best seen as kind of a semi-automatic design.
So
much faster, much more lethal than the guns that we had had before.
Yeah. Why did the northeastern United States become the Silicon Valley of guns? Is there a reason it all happened in that part of the country?
Yeah, that's another interesting thing because today I think the Northeast is more associated with a gun control sentiment. But it was actually the gun breadbasket of the 1800s and into the 1900s. Some of that has to do with the concentration of skilled labor. These gun industrialists were creating the first generation of sort of industrial workers, and that tended to be concentrated and grouped in New England, and also the ease of transportation with waterways.
It's all well and good to make a fortune selling guns when your country happens to be at war. What was a 19th century firearms industrialist to do when a truce was declared?
Yes. The relationship between the military and war and the gun industry is actually a really complicated one. On the surface, we think, for example, the Civil War, this was great business for the gun industry. And for some, it was. Not for Oliver Winchester. He actually never got a big Civil War contract. But for others, including Remington, the war was a great boom in business. Grim as that is. But once the war ended, the economy, the war economy of the guns crashed, and typically the gun industrialist is left having overbuilt, overexpanded to meet wartime demand. So these gun industrialists, especially Oliver Winchester, quickly learned that there was this downside to tying their fortunes to the military and to war, and that they'd be tying themselves to a boom and bust economy.
All right, we'll talk in just a moment about what they did about that with my guest, historian Pamela Haig. Her new book is called The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like Diane Jay, internationally published creative writer. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with historian Pamela Haig, author of The Gunning of America, The Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. So, Pamela, if you make guns and you've had a lot of military contracts domestically, maybe the first thing you want to do is look overseas and see if you can secure some contracts there.
Yeah, this is one of the most interesting aspects and hidden aspects of the history of the American gun culture. In the years before and after the Civil War, that industry survived very much on non-U.S. international business. And this was dramatic, and it applied to all of the big major gun makers of the day. It's interesting that, you know, we think about America having this totally unique relationship to guns today, but from the perspective of the gun business and the gun industry, it's really better viewed as part of this international global phenomenon in the 19th century. So given the struggles of trying to get military business for Winchester and Colt and others, and the difficulties of developing the commercial market, which didn't seem to be adequate for the kind of production that these industrialists could undertake. Winchester and Colt and Smith & Wesson and Remington all looked abroad. And I mean everywhere. It would be challenging to find one continent, perhaps even one country, that wasn't to some extent getting armed by gun makers from Connecticut and Massachusetts in the 19th century. For example, Remington had a huge contract in 1870 to make 141,000 rifles for the French. Winchester himself survived in 1870, selling 20,000 to the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire. In 1866, he sold weapons to the Juarez Revolutionary Forces in Mexico. And those are only a few of the examples. Samuel Colt had really trailblazed the path in the 1850s. Most of the gun industrialists sold quite profligately to the Russian Tsar. So when we think about the customer for the American-made gun, you know, we might think of Charlton Heston or John Wayne. We don't really think of the Russian Tsar, you know, Tsar Nicholas II. You know, we don't think of the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire. We don't think of the King of Sardinia, you know, Garibaldi. But these were individuals who were buying American arms and really keeping the gun industry going and keeping it in business, you know, in years when this was the greatest market and this was the greatest source of demand.
Why do you think all those places didn't develop the kind of self-identification, you know, between guns and their culture? They use guns in wars, and certainly we know weapons last a long time, right? If you take care of one, it can last for decades and function just as well as it did the day you bought it. Why don't we see in Europe and or even in Mexico the kind of association with guns that we see in this country today?
Yeah, well, that's a great question and a really complex one. With lots of different answers. One of the answers is that weapons still tended to be more tied toward military use, toward government, toward the idea that this was something you'd use with a militia, you know, for collective self-defense. In the United States, guns, whether because of the legacy of the Second Amendment or for other reasons, the frontier, these are some of the common ones, they're more associated with individual ownership. And today they have, you know, somewhat powerful anti-government kind of mystique, that it's you standing against tyranny. So that's part of it. It's also worth considering that in the United States, we did have this flourishing gun industry. And as we were arming the rest of the world, these countries had that industry diminish and decline. They didn't develop it. The fact that we had gun industrialists and a powerful gun industry in this country also encouraged that gun industry to find customers in the United States and develop a commercial market. So that exerted some pressure, you know, culturally on the development of commercial interest.
So over time, as you say, and I'm paraphrasing here, guns went from being something that was necessary but not especially loved to something that was not especially necessary but very much loved. What did the manufacturers and their marketing teams have to do with that shift in affection?
I think the gun industry itself is a hugely overlooked part of the story. Clearly, the gun industry did not invent the idea of loving the gun out of whole cloth or on its own or as some manipulative ploy, you know, to get Americans more heavily armed. But the gun industry is almost invisible in our narratives about how we ended up a gun culture in the 21st century, and it shouldn't be invisible, because the gun industry clearly had the deepest investment in promoting and celebrating and selling the idea of the American gun. Now, what happened at the turn of the century is that this was a very different country. You know, as we were entering the 1900s, we were a more urban society. The economy was much more modern and sedentary and based in the office. We were a truly post-frontier society. So maybe things could have gone either way. You know, there were many Americans in the early 1900s who looked at the pistol as a great nuisance and wondered why it was that it was around. Why would we need guns? So Americans at this time are becoming a little more gun conscious. They were either becoming more averse to the gun or developing a deeper affection for the gun. And the gun industry's contribution here, its transition, at least it's particularly evident in advertisement, was toward emphasizing all of these intangible, symbolic values and feelings that could be associated with the gun. So they began to emphasize the gun as a totem of manhood and masculinity. They drew on the vocabulary of psychology and talked about a natural instinct to own a gun. The Winchester Archive even includes a discussion of the shooting instinct, you know, that they thought was present in most all humans, and particularly in boys. So there's a real effort to tap into a deeper feeling and longing for a gun rather than just talking about how a gun works. So really the shift is from how a gun works to how it makes you feel. And I think that is part of why in the 20th century, when Americans arguably didn't need guns to the extent that they might have in earlier times, really embraced the gun, you know, as part of the culture, as a political symbol as well.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Milton on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Milton.
Yes, I just wanted to make a comment. It's been sort of an observation. I lived in rural areas, including Alaska, and what I saw was people collected guns almost like you, people who had potato chip. You couldn't just eat one, you know. there are so many variations of one or other type of gun that they would collect, you know, like three or four different ones, and you go to a gun club and there would be bragging rights about, you know, you've got the latest 50 caliber this or whatever. But there also is a huge, huge industry based on parts and mm-hmm. various kinds of, I don't know, things you can add to guns, like gun sights that cost $500 or $600 that are electronic, and or folding stocks, and mm-hmm. and just many, many different interchangeable parts that become almost toy-like. And I think there's a huge industry that has to do with just that appeal for the mechanics of it.
What do you know about mm-hmm. that, Pamela?
Now, it's a really good point. And statistically, the caller's correct, because the trend today is for fewer Americans to own more guns, whereas in the 1950s, maybe 50% of households had one gun. Today, it's fewer individuals owning more. And historically, this is really interesting because, again, around the turn of the century in the 1890s and the 1900s, there emerged in the gun industry press and in its memoranda and whatnot, this figure that they called the gun crank, okay? And the gun crank will sound familiar because this was a new kind of customer, and he was very interested in talking about the mechanics of the gun and ventilating his views, as one article put it, about the very latest technology. And there's this great correspondence that I talk about in the book between these Winchester vice presidents and executives, and they're trying to figure out what to do with this figure of the gun crank, because they were thinking, well, our customer is still really the ordinary shooter, you know, the farmer's boy, and this is how they defined him. You know, maybe just needs a gun for very practical purposes. But maybe we should turn this gun crank figure in a few different directions and see if we can use him to boost that bottom line. And, you know, maybe we need to pay attention to this new figure. And arguably, although at first they were a little confused by him, this gun crank was very much their ideal modern consumer. Because, as the caller is pointing out, they like guns just for the guns, just for the beauty of it, the design, the mechanics. And I think that that's been a problem with gun control discourse, because I think advocates of gun control sometimes get to this idea of, well, you don't need all these guns. But it's almost like shoes or clothing. I mean, they're things that we don't need, but we want to possess them for other reasons. And the gun owning population, I think a lot of those gun owners feel the same way.
I had not given much thought before to the fact that the, like, Wild West shows that traveled around to entertain people, and they did trick riding and trick shooting and that sort of thing, and they had this whole, you know, set of celebrities that were on this circuit. They were, in many ways, marketing tools for the gun industry.
Yes. Incidentally, they were in the 19th century. And then in the 20th century, you know, really in the mid-1900s and 1950s after World War II, the amount of popular literature and popular culture around the gun really explodes. You know, you have about 1,400 Western movies between the mid-1930s and the 1960s. 35 million paperbacks, Western paperbacks, are sold. And at this point, the gun industry did become more self-aware about, well, we can, you know, talk to the movie studios about using what gun they're going to use in the movie Winchester 73, and we can, you know, sponsor national contests to find the Model 73. And so there was a bit of product placement or kind of cross-promotion that began to happen in the mid-1900s. A lot of what we think we know about guns in America really comes from the mid-20th century, talking about the frontier and talking about the Wild West and militias and the revolution.
How have gun ads evolved over time? I'll confess I don't read a lot of publications that feature advertisements for guns, so I just don't see them. But there are places where you can see them every day, every week.
Right. Well, that alone is a major change because, you know, in the 1870s, you would encounter a lot of gun ads in, again, places that were selling tools. So in American Agriculturalist or the Rural New Yorker, or in the military magazines like Army and Navy Journal. Then at the turn of the century, there were ads in places like Literary Digest, you know, Saturday Evening Post. These were general interest magazines, to say nothing of the fact that Sears and Roebuck was selling guns through the mail. So there were a lot of publications in the early 1900s where you would encounter gun advertisements. Today, that's a much more specialized niche. And the ads, I actually don't spend a lot of time on the 21st century ads myself. There are a lot of people doing research on that. But my impression is that they really do emphasize a lot of the sort of home protection, self-defense. You know, this is a big, dangerous world out there. You need to arm yourself. You can't rely on institutions to protect you or the police. And there's a very heavy emphasis on that.
Who were the sort of charter members of the National Rifle Association, and what was their mission?
Well, it's hard to imagine a time when we didn't have the NRA with us and as part of our culture. But it was actually, in its first iteration, formed in 1871 by some Civil War veterans who were actually alarmed at the really poor marksmanship that they were observing in some National Guardsmen and among American men generally. So their mission was to promote rifle practice and readiness. And the organization actually went dormant in 1892 and then came back in 1904. And at that time, it certainly wasn't a lobbying organization per se. Its major legislative mission was to get more rifle ranges in the states so that Americans could practice their marksmanship. And the organization at the time observed that they thought there were only really about a third of the states that had any kind of decent ranges. So its genesis was in trying to remedy what was actually an indication that Americans weren't so fluent with guns. They actually didn't know how to handle rifles.
Early questions over gun regulation had to do with whether African Americans had a right to gun ownership.
Yeah, this is part of the gun regulation history and legacy. There were always thousands of local regulations on gun etiquette and how guns could be used in public. So that was always part of the mix. And that was certainly true in the West as well. At the federal level, one of the first cases, Supreme Court cases, 1876, concerning the Second Amendment, was about whether or not African Americans essentially could own firearms, because many of the codes in the South were prohibiting that.
So who stood up for their rights?
Well, ironically, given the political landscape today, supporters of the rights of freed men and freed blacks said, look, you know, the Second Amendment gives these citizens the right to bear arms. States should not be allowed to regulate ownership, you know, or prohibit African Americans from owning guns. And in the South, they were saying, oh, no, we think that states should be able to do this. And the Second Amendment doesn't prohibit this, which is ultimately what the ruling concluded.
We're speaking this hour with historian Pamela Haig about her new book, The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. We'll resume our conversation in a few minutes. If you'd like to be part of it, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can send a tweet to the show account, that is at KERA Think. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in a few minutes with Pamela Haig.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like former student Dr. Candace Bledsoe, educator and community leader in diversity and inclusion. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with historian Pamela Haig about her new book, The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. Pamela, let's talk about Sarah Winchester. Why did she feel responsible for harm done with guns that she did not possess?
Right. So she was kind of my muse for this whole story, as I was saying earlier. The legend holds that Sarah Winchester was a spiritualist, and this would not have been unusual. It's quite likely she knew about that movement and might have been part of it. Spiritualism was this belief that the world of the dead is overlaid with the world of the living, and that we can communicate with the spirits of those who have passed. And Sarah Winchester, as the Winchester gun fortune grew and grew and the factory began to prosper, Sarah's personal fortunes declined. She never managed to have a living baby, a baby who survived more than a month. Her husband died of a very gruesome case of tuberculosis in 1881. And the legend holds that she consulted with a medium thereafter, and this medium told her, you're being haunted in this life by the spirits of everyone killed by these rifles. And that kind of view of responsibility and accountability wasn't entirely outlandish or unheard of. There were a lot of spiritualist writers at the time who argued that we carry with us the consequences even of things that we're only indirectly responsible for. She had made a huge fortune through marriage off of these rifles.
Wars aside, were firearms often associated in Sarah Winchester's lifetime with crime?
No, that's another interesting twist on the history. I think the West, we tend to overestimate the amount of gun violence in the Wild West. It wasn't as wild as we think it was, and underestimate the number of gun regulations that did exist in the West. It's really in the 1920s that the gun becomes the weapon of choice in homicide. In the 1920s, it's accountable for about 71% of homicides. And also in the 1920s, we had a much higher homicide rate than Great Britain or France. We had about 10,000 homicides in 1928, and France had about 520, and Great Britain maybe 284.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. We have Paul on the line in Dallas. Hi, Paul.
Yes, I'm sorry I didn't catch your guest's name, but I was wondering if she could comment on the National Firearms Act, which was enacted, I think, in the 30s in response to machine gun violence, but it also required registration, fingerprints for possession of silencers, short-arm rifles.
Go ahead, Pamela.
Yes, that's a great question. This 1934 National Firearms Act was really the first serious effort at federal firearms regulation. And it's also a moment when you can kind of begin to see modern gun politics emerging. So it's fascinating for that reason as well. The act was largely in response to the bootlegger, gangster, urban violence of the 1920s with submachine guns. And in fact, most of those submachine guns, if not all of them, could be traced to one contract that the Colts Company fulfilled for Auto Ordnance, which held the patent on the machine gun. They intended it to be a military weapon, but when that contract in South America fell through, the Tommy guns ended up being sold in the American commercial market, and they armed almost every bootlegger of the 1920s. So this act was very much in response to this explosion of the gangster violence of the 1920s. But as the caller points out, it was a really ambitious act. It wanted to have a very ambitious registration system, and it also wanted to include legislation against pistols and revolvers. So at this moment, the NRA is kind of beginning to develop its lobbying sea legs, you know. So it mobilizes its members to write in against this legislation. But its voice wasn't as categorical as it is today. The NRA did say, look, if this legislation was confined just to submachine guns and sawed-off shotguns, we could support it. On the other side, there were a lot of thinkers at the time who thought, well, the government can help solve this problem. A lot of women's organizations were mobilizing in support of this very ambitious legislation. And some of the very familiar cliches that we would recognize on bumper stickers today were becoming evident in this debate. The idea that those who supported the legislation were sentimentalist, and they were human conduct governors, and they were trying to control honest, law-abiding citizens. And the idea that if you regulate one gun, in their publication, the NRA likened guns to a bundle of sticks. And they said, if you begin to regulate, you know, one of these guns, the rifle's going to fall eventually. So it's in the context of this 1934 legislation, you begin to see that all-for-one, one-for-all strategy emerge, where ultimately any legislation against any kind of gun would be seen as equally invasive.
By the way, you can tune into All Things Considered this afternoon beginning at 4 for coverage of the shooting today on the UCLA campus that has left two people dead. Pamela, do you see a relationship between American gun culture and mass shootings?
Well, that would be difficult to pin down in terms of, you know, concrete evidence, but certainly the quantity, the sheer quantity of firearms in this country and the extent to which we have access to more lethal firearms has to be contributing in some way to that. I haven't done a lot of research on the 21st century context to know, but mass shootings are on the rise. They've only been really documented for the last decade or so. But the trend is toward more of these incidents.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Travis on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Travis.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
So I believe the term that you used earlier was gun crank. Is that correct?
Yeah, that wasn't a term I invented. That was the term
okay.
in the...
Okay, well, it rang true. I feel the same way. Personally, and I grew up in a family where guns were just, you know, respected, and we were taught at a very young age that all guns were treated as if they are loaded. And in mm-hmm. that respect, I feel like a lot of people tend to think of guns in a very, like, sort of the way that people do with snakes. If you don't know that one is venomous, you're going to mm-hmm. avoid all snakes, and you kind of, mm-hmm. I kind of equate the same thing with guns. But in any case, my younger brother fell on hard times, and he feels the same way I do about guns. He's got quite a few. And if you buy guns that are of good quality, you can sell them for almost what you bought them for. And he fell on hard times after losing his job and was able to sell guns and pay his rent. So there's another way that they can benefit people these days.
Thanks very much for your call. How has the, I mean, I know that you're not doing a lot of 21st century stuff, but can you talk a little bit about the relationship, changing relationship between the NRA and major gun manufacturers over time?
Yeah, it's really important to note that historically, and it's even true to some extent today, we tend to think the NRA and the gun industry are walking in lockstep and the NRA is representing the gun industry's interests, but that's not actually entirely the case. For example, in the 1930s, during the hearings around the firearms legislation, the gun industry was trying to be super cooperative, you know, and say there is no reason why we should ever be selling submachine guns to American citizens or civilians. They were in complete agreement with that premise. But the NRA was chided by some of the committee members for being these impassioned hobbyists, you know, who were less willing to be flexible. Among many other differences, the NRA today really seeks publicity. I mean, it's a political organization, and the gun industry absolutely wants to avoid that. So in the late 1990s, when there was a class action suit against the gun industry that was quite galvanizing, there was a lot of tension between the NRA and the gun industry. The gun industry, Smith & Wesson, wanted to do an elaborate code of ethics for their dealers. Colts wanted to settle. There was a lot of tension and bickering and disagreement between the NRA and the gun industry. So they don't actually walk in lockstep, and that would be an interesting, you know, approach with politics today. I mean, there are ways that maybe a business-focused approach might be more useful than going up against the NRA.
To say that our ideas about guns in this country have been informed by the industry that produces them and creates advertising to sell them makes perfect sense. You've made a great case for it. Is that really any different, though, than the way Americans feel about cars or about leather shoes or refrigerators or any of the other things that are part of our lives?
No, actually, I don't think it's different. And I think that's sort of the big news. We've grown up with the idea, or at least I did, you know, this relationship to guns is based on exceptionalism. It's based on the Second Amendment. And indeed, the Second Amendment is a really exceptional part of the gun in American culture. But that's one part. And when it comes to the gun industry, the fascinating story out of the centuries is that the gun industry was like other industries. In some ways, it was exceedingly unexceptional. It relied on the same kind of corporate warfare to stay alive in the 1880s. It used some of the same marketing techniques that other businesses used. And then at the turn of the century, like many other businesses, you know, whether they were selling mouthwash or ties, they developed this theory of sales that what you wanted to do was stimulate desire for your product. You didn't want to just settle for the customers that you could easily reach. You wanted to expand your market, and you wanted to tap into desire and emotion and feeling. And to me, that's quite intriguing, that the gun industry and this legacy of the gun in America has a lot to do with the ordinary practices of a business being a business.
I wonder if any of the market demand will change over time in that, you know, the way that we're able to sell Americans things that they already own right now is that you add more features, more functions onto something, right? What used to be a cell phone is now a little computer and a game device and a map and a bunch of other things. There is still one function for a gun.
There is one function, but the major sea change historically has been this move from the gun as functional tool to the gun as a totem, you know, to an object that its owners really identify with on a deeper level. So while the gun sort of mechanically is somewhat similar to how it was in the mid-1800s, what's really changed is how we feel about guns, the meanings we associate with them. Today, a lot of trends are against the guns. Not only are guns made to last, which has always been true, but the intergenerational trend has been away from hunting. There are more female-headed households where guns aren't used or owned as frequently. Fewer households own guns. But what's happening is that the guns have just even a political value today. I know people who buy guns simply because they're disgusted with gun control legislation in the state of Maryland, and they want to own a gun to show that they can. So I think the ways that guns sell today and the ways that they're marketed aren't necessarily about need or about their function or the mechanics. But it is about creating a sense of pleasure in having a variety of guns, different kinds of guns, and having more of them.
Do you think that political totemization causes people who might want a gun to choose not to buy one? You know what I mean? Like, are there some people who think, I can't buy a gun because it doesn't reflect my politics?
I think the trend is more in the other direction. Mm-hmm. I think there are some silent gun owners. I mean, I own a gun myself. I think that there are gun owners who aren't members of the NRA, and they don't really look at it as something that they have a deep investment in. But typically now, when there's new gun control legislation proposed, in some states you'll see skyrocketing applications for guns. So ironically, the attempt at gun control could be quickening gun desire and gun demand. It becomes its own kind of marketing.
The new book by historian Pamela Haig is called The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. Pamela, it's been really interesting. Thanks very much for making this time for us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones today from Elizabeth Myung. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. The show's Twitter handle is at KERA Think, and our email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.